You're listening to episode 21 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this interview, we talk with Jim Pinto. Running time for this interview is 59 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
My name is Chad.
This is Wayne.
And this is Chris.
And joining us today is Jim Pinto.
Hey, guys.
All right. Jim was on an interview with us once before about 2 years ago. But for anyone that's new to the show, and also just to talk about what's happened in Jim's life since 2009, Jim, could you give us a quick resume?
Yeah, I left AEG back in 2005, and then I went back in 2007, late 2007, early 2008.
Now, let's start by explaining, what is AEG?
AEG, Alderac Entertainment Group. They put out Legend of the Five Rings, Seventh Sea. What else would they be known for? The Initial D card game, Warlord card game, the Farscape role-playing game, if anybody ever played that, the Stargate role-playing game, if anybody ever played that.
Boatload D20 supplements back in early 2000s.
Yeah, I did all of the D20 supplements back in early 2000s, yeah.
Shadus Magazine.
Shadus Magazine, that was... I killed that in 96. and so I left, and then I went back for a couple of years, and then just last August, I left again. Not this past August, I'm sorry, but a year ago, August. 15, 16 months ago, I left again. I won't be going back.
Left on good terms?
I did not leave on good terms. And I'm not going to badmouth anybody or anything like that, but I thought I was going back under the right auspices, and it's just foolish of me to go back. And so I didn't get what I wanted out of the experience.
So what are you up to right now? What are your plans from here?
I've been doing a lot of freelance graphics on the side in the meantime. My wife makes a lot more money than I do, so I just a stay-at-home husband.
I am jealous.
Nice.
But I've been sort of working on my own private projects here and there. And then I did some graphics for a company in France that paid me a crap load of money last year. And little projects like that have been keeping me afloat, you know, 10 hours a week sort of thing.
That sounds like a brutal work schedule.
How do you fit in tea times?
Jeez. If I golfed or cared about golf, I may have to spend more time on the greens. But actually, I just waste my time with porn.
Is that really time wasted? I mean, it feels like a waste immediately afterwards, but then, you know, but then a couple minutes later, you're like, it was time not too badly spent. Pat, you concur?
Yeah, Pat's dicking around on the phone over here and didn't hear any of that. I mean, it's like...
No pun intended.
It was the lowest softball pitch the man has ever gotten in his entire history on the show.
And he's playing Angry Birds.
Yeah, for the first time. Never played it before.
Glad to have you here, Pat. Glad you at least brought your ice. You'll contribute something to this show. It'll be your damned ice. All right, Jim.
Maybe we left on bad terms last time and Pat just doesn't want to talk to me.
No, I wasn't on the last episode or on the one that you were on.
So, yeah. Yeah, maybe
not that you can tell
that.
A difference.
That's right. I'm just getting warmed up now.
All right.
It's going to be great. Right, Dan? Would you like to go on?
I would.
You sure?
You want to shut up?
No.
Okay.
I'm on a roll now.
Go ahead. What's on your mind, Pat?
Well, you know, certain things.
That's really...
Thanks. Wow, fascinating. That's a hell of a contribution.
How much
are
you paying this guy?
Not enough.
Jim, I have a question for you. And based on whether your answer satisfies me will determine how I put your name in the show notes. You're the first person I've ever said this to. You always put your name in lowercase letters.
Yes.
Now, this is an honor that I reserve for E.E. Cummings.
Sure, absolutely.
Why is your name in lowercase letters, and why ought I put it in lowercase letters?
I don't have a great answer. Everybody asks me this. I always give a different answer every single time, but
okay.
I'll give you the real story. Do you want the real story, Dan?
Yes, I want the real story.
Back in college, it goes all the way back to college, back to my arrogant days, I was taking an etymology class, and I was learning the root of words and the fact that capital letters were just something invented to signify the beginning of a sentence, and people like Samuel Webster just had really big egos, and they said, hey, let's capitalize names. And I got it in my head that it just looked better all lowercase, and then I started doing graphics, and it did look better all lowercase, regardless of what kind of font I was using. That's really what happened, and I just liked it lowercase. I didn't like it uppercase.
In keeping with that, to be consistent, do you also avoid the letter Y and W?
Do I avoid them?
Yeah. Because if memory serves, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, I know someone's going to be looking at Wikipedia and correct me on the forums, but I believe Y was originally a single letter to represent TH. And W, yes. I don't remember its origin, but originally V was W. So I know those are both relatively, well, relatively in terms of human
but they're
history.
Not egotistical.
Okay. And that's true. There's neither a Y or a W in your name. So, like, if you were like J-Y-M Pinto, would you change that to J-T-H-M Pinto?
No, I don't think for the purposes of phonetics I would do that because they don't even match anymore. We use Y completely different of its origin now.
I like where this is going. I really do.
I do too. I'm kind of grooving the fact that I just suddenly, you know, became unimportant in the room.
I did not know that.
If it's any consolation, my name is in lowercase, so I'm usually the least important person in the room.
You know, my son is learning how to write now. They're trying to get him to write in lowercase. He writes everything in uppercase. So he's just an egotistical little bastard.
He's writing for the internet.
Yeah, that's true.
He's already yelling.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe he's not doing it on purpose. Maybe he's just enraged.
Oh, he's enraged.
Your son's not enraged. I know
you. Oh, he's after last night. We played Uno. My son, my five-year-old son, loves card games now, much to the chagrin of my wife, who taught him card games. He wants to play card games all the time. So finally last night, since I wasn't playing in my WoW group, I had time to burn. So he,
you emerge from your dungeon all stinky and unshowered, and you're like, I'm not playing. Wow, where is my family? Oh my, how you've grown, son, over the years since I've seen you last.
You know, when I first started playing WoW, my son was 3. Now he's 5. I don't know where the time went. Anyway, so he got me. You know,
and
he
Pat
pulled me
has
in
a 3-hour dump built up.
They pulled me in to play card games, so we played Uno, and it was Uno Reflex, and we're not using the Reflex thing. Don't ask me why, but we're not, so we're just playing standard Uno, and I just cleaned up, and I won 3 games in a row.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Your son is 4?
He's 5.
Your son is 5?
Yeah.
And you smashed him
on
purpose in Uno?
Hey, look,
what are you,
game.
Chris? Why didn't you just slit his throat?
Hey, Pat, thank you for teaching your son the valuable lesson that people don't always win.
I'm still pissed
5?
Off. I'm still pissed off that the little bastard broke my streak. I was going for 4 in a row, and he won one there, and so I had to come back and win the next one. So I did win 5 games last night, but it was not a streak. I was
good job.
I was dejected, but I taught him the finer points of you know, gamesmanship of when you win. Like, you know, I'd win the game. I threw the last card. I just laid it down. I threw it down and I scattered the cards all over the table.
I did a Pat jumping up and thrusting his pelvis.
Yeah.
In your face.
And at
in
the end
face.
Of it, at the end of it, we had a discussion about how I was a role model, a bad role model. I was teaching him an important lesson of being a bad role model.
No, Pat.
This is not how you should
win a game.
You
were teaching him that life does keep score. There are winners and losers. Yeah.
At 5?
Yes.
Dude, I can remember suffering defeats in life earlier than 5.
At 4? Because before that, that doesn't really matter.
I am the second of 4.
Yeah.
I have siblings at 2-year intervals. You cannot sit down with 3 or 4 children expect all of them to win.
I am not.
My parents didn't have to hand me defeat.
See, I'm not one of these people who are like, oh, well, if there's a softball game, everybody wins, or we play soccer, nobody keeps score and all that. No. You know, the game has rules, game has winner and losers and stuff. But
and the ref is wrong.
Smashing a 5-year-old is... Dad of the year.
I won the game. I mean, what was I supposed to do? You know what? So I got to the point where in the 3rd game, this may have been the 4th game. This is the one that the little stole from me. Uh-huh. Duncan was dealing the cards. And so he dealt out the cards. And I said, Duncan, I placed my hand over my cards that he dealt me. I said, Duncan, do you know what I'm doing here? Do you know what I feel? I feel a winner. Right here, this hand, a winner.
Mm-hmm.
And then he beat me.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was important for you to learn that you can't always win in life.
At long last.
That's
at
right.
37? Yes.
That's right, because, long you know, last. What I did last night about 3 o'clock, I went and I pantsed him. So, shows him.
That's right.
I'm the daddy. I'm the breadwinner in the house.
All right. So, Jim, this is going to be a wonderful transition here. But yeah,
that's fantastic.
Yeah. One of the things that you were talking about to us prior to recording that you said is of interest to you in the current state of role-playing games versus where you prefer them to be, and if I'm not getting this quite right, you can re-nuance it, is you talked about the true struggle versus the fluff. And the reason that I'm bringing this up is because actually Pat talking about devastating his child to tears with, you know, he loses it, you know, tells him there's no Santa, it's just his petty revenge. So,
spoiler.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry.
You can't recover from that.
I know. I cannot. I'm sorry.
You are just the bastard who ruined Christmas.
Yep.
If you listen, way to go.
You listen to Fear the Boot with your children. Fear the Boot lies.
That's right.
Personally, I'm with Chris. Chris is old enough that he was around when people first started talking about Santa. If anyone knows the truth of it, it's going to be Chris.
Chris was around for the 4th century Turkish monk or whatever that it came from. So
that's right. All right, I helped him construct the legend and spread the word.
So back to Jim. Jim, do you want to talk about your interest in true struggle versus what you were calling a fluff struggle in role-playing games, and explain what that means?
It sounds like a competitor to True Dungeon at Gen Con. It's
fluff
the
struggle.
No, true struggle. Like,
oh,
true struggle.
I was going to go there too. Fluff struggle is at a that I missed.
Fluff struggle is a game, but it's a completely different convention that isn't Gen Con.
Yeah. No, it's at Gen Con. It's over in the anime area.
Ah, I gotcha.
I think you guys hit on this when we were talking earlier. I don't remember who was in the background because all the voices sometimes sound the same. The idea of walking around and, you know, helping people milk cows or whatever in a fantasy setting in the village, that's not exciting. Nobody sits down to play a role-playing game because they want to milk the cows or they want to do the mundane tasks of daily life. And that I totally get that. But I don't want to sit down and play Ren Faire fantasy. I don't want to sit down and play a game where we're exploring our feelings about, how do I put this?
Brutally.
I don't really want to play a game that's meant for girls. That's just the best way to describe it. I'm not trying to be a sexist jerk, but I come from a... All right, then I am a sexist jerk.
Let's Did you write Cerberus?
20 pages.
Oh, my God. Wow, what a great tangent. I know exactly what you're talking about. Holy crap. I grew up just on different kinds of fantasy and different kinds of science fiction. I don't like sci-fi, and I see sci-fi and science fiction as very different. And I think a fantasy probably has something similar, where Tolkien fantasy is very different from everything else. Tolkien was writing about – he was writing with allegory. He was writing with theme. He was writing with meaning. He was writing with metaphor. He was writing with mirrored images from the real world put into this fantasy setting. He was telling a story about a larger picture of events that were bigger than the sum of the parts. And when you sit down to play Keep to the Borderlands, you're not exploring anything but, oh, there's a Minotaur in a 10-foot-by-10-foot room. I've got to go kill him. So far, so good.
Yeah, so far,
I'm getting you.
Okay.
So I think that let's call that genre gaming, if you will, instead of substantive gaming. I didn't come to gaming because I wanted to kill orcs. I came to gaming because I love telling stories and I love the richness of exploration. But that exploration has to go somewhere. Otherwise, I just sat around not talking to my friends. Gaming shouldn't be an impedance on me socializing with my friends. It should be part of the process of us building something together. I think we should walk away from a gaming experience saying, wow, I cannot believe how great that campaign was.
You want actual motivation when it comes to killing that Minotaur in that 10-by-10 room. If he's there, he's there for a specific reason that you must then confront him. This is what you're saying, as opposed to, right, oh, he's there and he has gold that we need to have.
Yeah, killing a monster, taking his stuff is boring because all I'm going to go do is buy a bigger widget to kill a bigger monster and take his bigger stuff.
I see you've played WoW.
I haven't. There's a reason I don't play WoW. But I love games like Assassin's Creed. I love games like Mass Effect, if we're talking about video games, because I feel like I'm exploring a story. And while I can't impact it in any way other than the way the writer wants me to, it's as close to a role-playing experience that I want that I can get with a video game. Mm-hmm. And if I sit down to play something like that game we were talking about earlier, which we still don't know the name of, about the two guys making out, that's interesting for somebody somewhere. Somebody that likes the Twilight books is going to find that game interesting.
Hell yeah, they are.
But
I had to put that in.
I'm not going to find that interesting, and I'm not going to want to sit down and do that, and I'm not going to judge it. I just don't want to be involved with it. I've gotten to the age now where I'm done judging it. I just don't want to be around it. And
Two guys kissing, the role-playing game aside, you're just not really into trying new stuff. You know exactly what you want out of the experience, and that's what you want.
You know, not to put words in Jim's mouth here, obviously he's here and speak for himself, but that's not the sense I'm getting so much as there's something specific he wants out of games a lot of newer games aren't offering.
Yeah, I'm working on a game called The Plague right now. Just a little indie thing that I decided to make for myself. I've run it about 10 times now. Each time I make it, each time we sit down and play it, it morphs a little bit here and there. But the game's about the isolation of people stuck inside a building while a plague ravages the world outside, and they have to start making hard decisions about how they're going to survive the plague, how they're going to make it through the day. And you don't play every single day. You don't play every single moment. The game picks, okay, day 6. There's a moment where you're all together in the room and you're running out of food. What do? Go. And so I originally designed the game with this idea that the players are not only dealing with the struggle of daily life, but they're also dealing with the isolation of being removed from this world of excess and this world of convenience that isn't there anymore. And I just couldn't get it, right? I will admit 100% that I failed in my design goal. But I wanted to explore that. I wanted to see where it was going to go, because I think that that is a much meatier exploration than, oh, am I really attracted to my servant boy or not?
Which is what this game that actually exists, but we can't figure out the name of, is about.
Yeah.
We keep referencing. It's about the game itself, the mechanics, the story, everything you do is it's a two-player game, role-playing game. And you play, what did you say?
It was a 16th century Spanish noble with a Scottish accent.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Highlander stable boy.
I don't know why it has to be a Highlander stable boy.
Tales of Ribaldry.
You've never heard. It's a comedy routine.
Oh, okay.
The whole fact that Sean Connery plays a 16th century Spanish nobleman with a Scottish accent, because every role Sean Connery plays has a Scottish accent.
Like a Russian sub pilot, because he isn't Russian. He's Scottish.
Yeah. I love Sean Connery, but it's the truth. That's all right, Chad. We'll just go on.
Excellent.
To kind of get an idea, when it comes to that kind of stuff and you want that story immersion, you know, what is your level of threshold for something like that? You personally, I mean, is this something that you've got to feel immersion almost right away? Or are you willing to wait a session or two to just see how things go and see how, you know, the party develops as a group and how the plot is, you know, laid out by the GM? Or how does that work for you?
I think it just depends on what you're doing. I mean, immersion out the gate is great because then everybody feels like they're, you know, you feel immersion as soon as you sit down to the opening 30 seconds. It's the Lord of the Rings movie. And I think that that's a wonderful ability on the director's part to be able to do that. But what ends up happening with gaming is it's this collective endeavor. And we can talk about the role of the GM at some point if you guys want to, and how I don't like all the work that's on his shoulders. But everybody at the table is responsible at some level for bringing fun to the environment. It cannot just be the GM. And as a result, that immersion isn't just the GM's responsibility. It's everybody's responsibility to buy in, to say, look, I may not like Greyhawk. I may not like Forgotten Realms. I may not like Lord of the Rings, but I am going to sit down and allow myself to be immersed because it's important for everybody else. And if that immersion can happen as soon as you sit down, that's great. But if it takes a session or two, that's okay too. But when you're playing an indie game, any of these new indie games that are done in 3 hours, that immersion's got to happen within seconds.
Go ahead and talk about that. Talk about the role of the GM.
I think when you sit down and you buy the TSR book du jour, TSR's not around anymore, the WotC book du jour, you're buying a book where the GM is running some sort of adversarial project for you to solve and compete with and fight and win against. I use win improperly there in the sentence context, but I do it on purpose because this winning mentality is what continues to put the players at odds with the GM. When the GM's role is to at some point entertain, but it's to facilitate. It's also to make sure everybody's having a fun time. He's there to administer and make sure that everybody's getting equal amount of screen time. And he's there to make sure that the monsters don't kill everybody, but at the same time challenge them. So he's got tons of jobs. And on top of that, he's got to immerse you. He's got to entertain you. He's got to do funny voices for the NPCs. And all you have to do is sit down with a bag of Cheetos and grunt when you roll a 20. And so D&D has taught people for so many years that somebody else has been saddled with the job of making it fun. And I am so against that thinking. And I've been fighting against it. And my groups, and every group I've been in, they come to understand this about me, that I will sit there and turn to them and I will say, okay, I need a name for a nobleman. Give me something. Okay, give me an affectation for him. Okay, he's missing an eye. Great, boom. And then the players are adding ingredients to the world too, so they don't feel like they're passengers in my story. Because yeah, it's not my story.
Wait a second, though, because I'm going to take just a small issue with that. Don't you feel, though, that doing that kind of thing kind of breaks that level of immersion? I mean, if you're presenting, okay, this nobleman comes out, but then you start asking the people for, you know, a little fiddly bits about him, then what level of importance does this guy really have if you're asking the players to contribute to his likeness?
It's very clear once they start playing what his level of importance is, right?
Chris, I got to agree with him. I mean, really, when a nobleman comes out, was it his name and missing eye that's important? If so, quite frankly, that's kind of a crappy NPC. I mean, if it's not his personality, his scheming, his angle on things, his politics.
But you can only put so much scheming and angles and box text and modules.
In fact, I actually like Jim's approach because, I mean, anyone who's listening to this podcast knows that as the leader of the GM party, I am a big proponent in the players carrying more water. And I am very grateful that my current group does. I've had past groups where they just sat down and expected to be spoon-fed a game. And my current group is wonderful about bringing things to the game and giving input. And one of the things that, Jim, for your sake, I don't know if you'll listen to the show or not, but Chad in particular is a big proponent of, is collaboration, where during the world building process prior to the game, that the players don't just bring a character, they bring a portion of the world, they bring plot points to the table that he will then work into the game in ways that, you know, they won't utterly defy what they had in mind, but won't go exactly as expected, because if they did, why play the game?
Right.
But you have thrown out something here that I love, because one of the things that we have talked about in the past is how do you come up with stuff on the spot? And we've had a variety of ideas, like keeping little charts of names or little note cards that have random personality traits or whatever. But I tell you, I love your way of killing two birds with one stone, of getting that diversity and inspiration and keeping the player involved by, instead of grabbing a note card, you turn to the guy to your left. And, you know, maybe in your notes, you know that this nobleman comes from this kingdom, claims to work for this guy, but is actually betraying the kingdom. But you still turn to the guy to your left and say, OK, what's his name? How's he dressed? And what's the first thing you notice about him?
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
I think it's great. Yeah. And
Chris
and
is wrong. I mean,
Chris is wrong, because the more it's a matter of buy-in, and the more the players create of the world around them, be it on a sort of micro level of saying this guy, this funny accent, this eye patch, this name, all the way out to taking on and creating part of the world, part of the story, part of the plot in a collaborative manner, it is buy-in. And the bigger thing that they create, the more important it is, the cooler it is, the more buy-in that they have.
Yeah, it's something that's actually been somewhat painful for me lately is reading the Penny Arcade comic. I like Penny Arcade. I followed their comic.
The way they play D&D is this dungeon bash, high-level, high-powered dungeon bash.
And let me start by saying, I like those guys. I love their comic. I love what they do. And as we have said on Fear the Boot since its beginning, I will say again, the only way to fail at a role-playing game is not to have fun. If they are having fun playing the game that way, they are doing it perfectly right. But
And I do have to say that the model that, if you follow Penny Arcade, the model he made where they were
amazing,
falling through, it was model-based combat, they were falling through the elemental plane of air, and it was eternal falling, where they had to fight the bad guys. Yeah. He made a 3D
and they had rules
falling.
For, like,
oh, yeah.
Accelerating. And great stuff, but the adversarial model that starts off with, you're in the dungeon, kill the monsters. My job as a GM is to defeat you.
Yeah.
I am bound by the rules, but otherwise it is my job to crucify your characters. It pains me. Once again, if that's how they play, yeah, great.
And you know, they're probably playing it up for, I think that partially they're playing it up for comedic value, but I think partially they're not too.
The impetus behind it is this is Gabe's first time.
Well, the impetus behind it is that is what Wizards of the Coast the is paying
absolutely
for the advertisement.
So yeah,
but yeah, I absolutely agree with you that I have never seen the Game Master player role as an adversarial one. I think when it is adversarial, the game is already off to a bad start. Even quite frankly, in a game like Paranoia, where yeah, part of the GM's job is being adversarial, but it's still being adversarial to the end of your enjoyment, not with the sole purpose of winning.
Yeah.
But I think that seeing it as an adversarial role is the de facto point of view that people have when they come together and they don't know each other. If you came at a con, everybody's just going to assume, okay, well, how are we going to defeat the GM? Like I said, that's the de facto point of view that people have because it's the easiest one to grok.
I am so lucky to have met you guys before I started.
Yes,
gaming.
You are.
What kind of D&D are we going to be playing here today with this GM? What are we going to do? How are we going to approach this? Nobody wants to sit down and have those kind of conversations because that takes you out of the immersion. That slows down play, and then the person that's the loudest usually is going to win their point of view anyway, and meek people don't care, et cetera, et cetera. So everybody just sort of goes with what they know. And I agree with you. I'm glad that you guys game that way, but I bet you would find the percentage of people don't.
What kind of reception have you gotten with that? I mean, when you go into a group and you turn to the guy on your left and say, give me something, bring more than the Cheetos, what kind of response do you typically get?
The first time, it's always shock. It's apprehension. They step out of the environment for a moment, or you know, they say, "Wait, well, what am I doing? What you want me to do? What?" A lot of these people, especially if they're third person role players and not first person role players, they don't know what to do. But I've been gaming with enough groups that I've just sort of whittled my way down to people that I'm comfortable with, which is maybe less than 10 now that I know of that I will put up with their shenanigans and they will put up with mine.
Yeah, that's a term I've never heard before. First person, and third person.
I've never heard of a third person role player.
Oh,
that's fascinating.
I've gamed with them. It's awful.
Wait, would be horrible.
I instantly know what I do, and I've seen people like that. But
I like Johan.
I would never thought about it.
Would punch them in the mouth if they third person role played with me.
I sneak quietly down the hallway. My character Yiro, because it's named my current character, disarms the trap, and I say good day, my lady. I found you, whatever. Or it's Yiro walks down the hallway quietly. Yiro disarms the trap. My character meets the lady.
I got in trouble with my other gaming group prior to the Star Trek game with the Forgotten Realms game we were playing. They were having a conversation with a Baelnorn, which was the good lich I mentioned several episodes back. And someone actually asked me for a link to that, and I was able to provide it. But Carla had to go down to this Baelnorn and try and implore him for help, because he was like this record keeper and sort of, not exactly, but the point is he really wasn't interested in the outside world. He just kind of watched this one hall, and she was trying to convince him, you have to get out there and get involved. And she went down there. Now, she's an inexperienced role player, so I'm not bashing Carlo, but she went down there and she said, I tell him what's going on. And I'm like, what do you tell him?
Everything.
And she's like, blah. I'm like, no, blah. I said, I want to know, because you are trying to convince this guy what you tell him. I know what his motivations are. If you say X, Y, or Z, he's going to move. If you say anything else, he's not going to care. You have to tell me what it is you're doing. Now, in her defense, she's an inexperienced role player who is learning and is getting better as she goes. But I have met people who are certainly
the lazies.
Yes, they are
the experienced role players.
They've been gaming for 20 years.
Yeah. You know, in her further defense, too, I have done that. And I think that there is an appropriate time to do blah.
Yes.
Like, especially when it's PC to PC.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I get the radio transmission that lays out the enemy plan, and Dan blahs me this huge
Pat
plan.
Pat heard me narrate the...
Right. Yeah. I was going to say,
Pat,
we do that at
Pat's
our table.
Character comes around, what's going on? Blah.
Yeah.
You know, that's acceptable.
In that case, but I think in that case, I think that's
unless
a very good thing
altering
because...
the information somehow.
Well, yes, but if you're just going to do it verbatim... It's a time-saving move. And it will actually, I think it can help keep the immersion in the game by not having to simply regurgitate all this again, wasting more time, and you can, you know, flow on with the plot.
You know, and if your character is more eloquent than you, you don't always necessarily want to go through and explain it all.
Yeah.
But you do have to at least hit the high points.
Yeah.
In our D&D game, when I played a bard, I would say, this is what the song's about, but I'll be damned if I'm going to sing to you guys. It's not going to happen.
I really hate the rules are there for a socially handicapped people. You always roll bluff because what if the person isn't a good enough liar because you're socially introverted? I hate that line of thinking, but to a point, I agree with Wayne. I don't want to hear Wayne sing his bard song. Wayne doesn't want to sing his bard song. Why don't we just roll for that? Yeah.
Jim, I wanted to ask you because you had brought this up when we were talking about topics, but you wanted to bring up the new renaissance of role-playing or what you consider that to be. And right. I also want to make sure that we lay out the term that we came up with, which will now really define the whole indie game movement, because we have a much better term for it. So.
Sure. Let me paraphrase what we talked about last time real quick, is that, you know, we went through the 70s and 80s, which there weren't a lot of games offered, and so everybody just owned and played everything that was out there. But everything was just a variegation of something else. If you weren't playing D&D, you were playing Star Frontiers, and in Star Frontiers you were just killing things with laser pistols. You weren't really playing a different game. In Boot Hill, you were killing bad guys with guns. It was still dungeon crawling, but with different weapons, different names for these weapons. And then Vampire comes along and it creates this whole new first renaissance of role-playing game where story and motivation take forefront and people aren't just killing stuff. You can go sessions after session after session without killing anything in Vampire, which seems contrary to the theme of the game, the genre of the game, if you will. And so then CCGs came along and killed all that. And then in 2000, D&D comes along and it reinvigorates everybody to want to play role-playing games again. But then the Splatbook epidemic, I think, crushed people's enthusiasm, if you will. And we had a long drought of nothing. And while the indie movement's been going on since 2000, and I think Sorcerer goes back to 1998, this new renaissance of what I'm calling hipster games is effectively exploring design space and exploring game potential that we'd never seen before with role-playing games, but at the same time is so splintered that it has the potential to choke itself out from oversaturation in a shorter time than we ever saw a fad of role-playing disappear, if that makes sense.
Let's pause here for a moment to define what we mean by hipster game, because this was kind of a phrase we invented in the pre-recording. One of the difficulties of really describing a lot of the games that are out there now is this phrase of indie game keeps getting used.
Right.
Except indie obviously is short for independent, and then you have this sort of blurry lines of, well, what exactly does it mean to be an indie game? And even if you're able to define that, really what we're talking about is a matter of scale. We're not talking about the content of the game. And so we came up with this alternate term of the hipster game to describe something that it doesn't matter who it's made by. It could be made by one guy in his garage. It could be made by 1,000 people at some mega corporation. But the point is that the game is highly conceptual, experimental, typically very focused, that you're going to play one sitting or two sittings. And right. Even if you play this game with 100 people, you may see various angles of this story or variations on a theme, but you're not going to really deviate from that theme. You're not going to get something completely different. I
would go so far as to say the thing that differentiates between a traditional role-playing game and a hipster role-playing game is that traditional role-playing games are setting dependent. They're almost universally setting dependent. So you know what the world is before you ever put on a pair of shoes for your character, before you ever decide what kind of hairstyle he has. You know that there are orcs, there's elves, there's dwarves, and you know how they feel about one another. And you just absorb all of that before you can sit down and make a character. A hipster game is relationship map dependent. And I don't care what setting we're playing in. My character knows you through a bad con artist deal that we did, and we've been on the run for 10 years. And so you have those very clear delineations between the design models because, again, and I'm not saying this pejoratively, but there's no other way to say it, the hipster model is based on the self-esteem generation, egocentrism. It's based on the sort of philosophy that I'm always happy and everything is about how I perceive the world. And I love that last bit of it, right? I love that perception is everything, because that really is a very, very human trait. And traditional role-playing games do not address that very well. But these two models of design are so different that I've used the phrase before to say, well, they're exclusionary. And I've heard some great arguments as to how traditional role-playing games are exclusionary. So the hipster model is just a new way of looking at something that we have to get out of our comfort zone to enjoy. And a lot of us get nervous about getting out of that comfort zone because, well, we know how to roll a d20 and we know that a battle axe does d8. And relearning that is a pain in the ass.
I really struggle with that definition, though, because that's how we play D&D. We care more before we start the game on how our characters interacted with each other.
Well,
we care more about that past experience.
But that's not the game that they're giving you. That's not the game that they published to hand to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I was going to say. That's something that we do. That's not the game.
A lot of people do.
Yeah.
That's the way it's presented.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think if you sat down and you did the fiasco set up for your D&D game before you actually sat down and did your D&D game, I think you'd have a blast with that portion of the gameplay. And I've written about six of these now, these play sets for Fiasco. And I got to tell you, it's among the best of the hipster indie games, but it's no longer even indie anymore. It's so popular and so successful that it's really becoming quite mainstream. But the play sets are what make that game what it is, because you have these relationship matrices, if you will, that involve everybody at the table with one another and before they even start doing anything.
One thing I'm seeing is that trend is going into more and more of the games that are actually made for full campaigns. You look at something like Dresden Files, that concept of every character's related to each other, you're building the world that you're playing in, even though it's a larger setting.
Sure.
All of that's built in, but that's a game that's designed for going through long campaigns and things like that.
But look at the list of writers on Dresden Files. Look at the list of writers on Smallville. They're all coming from the indie market first and then weaving their way into the traditional gaming market. So they are coming with a different background. They're coming with different experiences about what they want to see a game do.
You know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with traditional games.
I don't either.
And I don't think that there's anything wrong with indie games. But I'm interested in character. I'm interested in the story. I'm interested in the plot. And then the people I play with, who are also interested in these things too, are interested in, you know, the combat or the adventure aspect, the more traditional aspects.
I'm interested in the fusion of both.
Yeah, the fusion of both. And people tend to draw these battle lines, right? D&D sucks. It doesn't, you know, it's just a dungeon crawl. It's just you're playing WoW, you're pressing buttons, you're killing people and taking their stuff. Or people will be like, especially the people who hate indie games, are like, it's just a story stick game. It's a bunch of dirty hippies. All you do is you sit around, you talk about your feelings. You don't need a game master. There's no story.
Right.
You know, and I've heard it all. And it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. I read a book, and a book has all these things. When I play a role-playing game, I want to play a book because a book has characters. If it's a good book, the characters are interrelated. It has a plot. It has a story. It has a flow to it. And a role-playing game is, in its way, almost better than a book because you have control of it. It's like the movie analogy we always use. Or why should I play a role-playing game? Well, have you ever seen a horror movie? You know that scene where they're about to open up the door and you're sitting there in the chair like, don't open the door! Don't open the door, you idiot! What if you're playing that guy and now you don't have to open up the
door? Yeah, horror movies with Manim would be about 5 minutes long. I shoot his ass.
Yeah. And, you know, pulling it back, though, circling back around, though, to the indie versus traditional versus whatever, Chris and I, when we were at Gen Con together last, we did an interview with, I don't remember the guy's name because it was I was holding the camera. It was basically Chris and this guy talking. And Chris, you brought up a really, really good point of why are you calling role-playing games indie games? Why are you trying to separate this thing away from role-playing games, and these guys are traditional mainstream role-playing games, and these are the indie games. They're role-playing games. They're all games. You all play a role in them. We're all telling stories. It's a role-playing game. Some role-playing games are kind of like this. Others are kind of like this. Others are kind of like this. And they're published by all sorts of different people, and some are more popular than others.
I think that, you know, that was a realization of that delineation that's made, is that, you know, because, you know, despite the fact that, you know, we all have a various differences in approach, at the core of it, we're all still looking to, you know, I can get just as much of an enjoyable story out of sitting down with first edition D&D as I could with, you know, any kind of hipster game. And it might take me a little time to adapt to how it implements that stuff, but I'm still going to still get a good story out of all this. But you're right. A lot of people, they just don't seem to want to do that because they view it in a very linear term as to, well, this is really what this game is about, which is true because it's how it's presented to you. But it's what you do with it that really makes that difference.
I think if you sit down to play D&D and you've never played D&D before, there's a big learning curve, right? I got to figure out what strength is. I got to figure out, and they don't do THACO anymore, but they used to. I got to figure out what armor class means. Why does this weapon small and one-handed? Why is this weapon large and two-handed?
Why can I play Monopoly and the instructions are written on a board? But now I'm playing this game and it's in 15 books.
But you sit down for Fiasco, and I'm going to continue to use this because it really is an excellent model of the hipster design philosophy. In a four-player game, there's 8 index cards on the table, and that's it. And there's no learning curve to what's on those index cards because it's English. There's the argument, I think, a lot of the times from the new independent market as to why traditional games are so so hard to traverse, so hard to get into, is because
But the thing is that if you pick up a game like Burning Wheel, which many rightfully consider an indie game that's all about character and feeling and touchy-feely stuff that a lot of traditionalists hate, that has an argument, verbal resolution mechanic into it.
Luke Crane loves crunch.
Yeah,
and he will tell you crunch. As much. Yeah,
yeah. It is unabashedly crunchy.
He told me to my face as much that, he loves crunch. Yeah.
Everybody loves it, but not as many people play it. I've yet to sit down and play it because I can't find people that want to do it. But I think it's a wonderful exercise. I think it's a fantastic game. There's so much crunch there. And it does all those things that some of the other hipster games do, but it does it for the D&D crowd. It's just there's so much to learn to play that game, and it can take you 6 hours to make a character.
And that's cool because there are some people who are really into that. I am not one of them.
So, Jim, you were saying there was something that we apparently skipped over in our prior interview that you wanted to talk about. And it's always fun to put people into overly simplistic categories. So what are the 7 types of gamers?
So this is unofficial, but I know that marketing strategies have been done. Now it's going to be official now that I'm saying it.
Yes.
You're saying it on Fear the Boot. That's the specificness of that. If you said it anywhere else, nobody's going to listen to you. They don't give a shit. But if you say it here,
people will listen. They still don't give a shit, but they'll listen.
But it'll be fact now.
It's okay to cite us in a research paper. We're not Wikipedia.
Yes.
You can cite us in a research paper. People actually have cited us in research.
Well, awesome. I'd be citing myself because I'm the one that sort of put these titles together as far as I know. But it's based on
years
of being inside the industry, talking with other game companies, talking with people, reading articles. And basically, I've determined that there's 7 different kinds of gamers. And 4 of them are on what I would call the crunch side, and 3 of them are on the fluff side. So I'll do the fluff ones first because it's shorter and easier. You've got the casual gamer who just shows up because his buddies are doing it, and he doesn't buy product, so you don't market to him. You've got the actor who needs to know what his motivation is. And you've got the storyteller who's there because he wants to tell a story about a bigger picture, or he wants to connect lots of dots. But again, none of these 3 people really care about the rules of the game. They just want the experience. And then you have the crunch players who are the combat junkie, the min-maxer, the weekend warrior, and then again, a different type of casual gamer.
What's the weekend warrior?
The weekend warrior is the guy that doesn't really keep up on the rules. He just makes the 4 hours a week to game with his buddies. He doesn't really read the books all that well, and he just wants his character to do one thing really, really well. And so he makes sure that character is made to do just that one thing. and that's it. And so he shows up, he plays, boom, and then he doesn't talk about gaming when he's not there. The min-maxer, everybody knows what that is. And then the combat junkie is the guy that really gets into the simulation of the tabletop experience of where is everybody located on the map, what is everybody doing, no, you don't have enough actions to do that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That person really likes those kind of crunchy bits. And then you have the casual gamer on that side who enjoys all that simulationism, enjoys the moving pieces on the board, but he too doesn't buy any books. He just shows up because his buddies are doing it. And it's horrible to do those kind of demographics when you're a designer, but when you also have to work on the marketing side of things, you have to be aware of these archetypes. And then you go to enough game conventions, you work long enough in the industry, you see these trends. And you see who buys books and who does it. And really, the greatest example of this is just pick up any White Wolf Splat book and look how much of it is story and look at how much of it is crunch. And they've done their homework. They know exactly what percentage of each they need to put into a book. And that program works every single time for them because the crunchy players pick up the books because it's got enough special feats or powers in it. And then the story players pick it up because, oh, look, there's my motivation for hating yet another spirit of darkness.
Let me ask you something, though. If I look at myself as a gamer, in the right situation, I probably fall in all seven of those categories.
Right.
In most situations, I will probably fall into three or four of them.
Sure.
I am very much into the crunch and the rules. I'm not a huge tactical player. I'm not a min-maxer, but I very much enjoy the crunch, the simulation. But I'm also big into storytelling. I'm also big into character. And so what I'm trying to understand is, are these designations that you feel are useful at the table, useful in marketing, both, neither? What would you do with this information?
Well, if you're working in marketing, it's very important because then you know what kind of game you want to make. And we should probably talk about that at some point too, is marketing driving design, which never happens. But if marketing people know what kind of product people want, for instance, Games Workshop's very good at this, right? They are very good at giving people big, giant miniatures with lots of detail in them and broken rules for people to argue over.
And then they constantly fix those rules, so you have to buy new rules
and new models
and new models all the time.
I know another company that follows that strategy now that said that they wouldn't.
We'll swap the first letter of both parts of the name just to mask. Oh, I think you're talking about Privateer Press.
Yes.
Oh, wait, crap. It comes out the same way.
Nice. And so if you're designing or you're marketing, you probably need to be aware on some level about this. Otherwise, and I'll use Steve Long as an example. Steve's a longtime friend of mine. He does great work for Hero Games, but I don't like Champions. I don't like that many dice. I don't play any of the Hero Games products. And so I don't play Steve's products. But Steve makes a game for a subset of players that like that kind of crunch. So those players know what they're getting into when they buy a Hero Games product. And so they are aware of this model, even if it's intuitively and they haven't sat down and delineated these seven different kinds of gamers. They're still aware that their players like crunch. FOSSA was aware of this when they were making games, that they made games for people that liked crunch. There really wasn't a lot of story to FOSSA products. They wanted you to think that there was, but there wasn't the level of story that you would say get in Legend of the Five Rings, which was a game made for the story crowd and not the crunch crowd. But if you're a GM and you're looking around the table, you need to be aware of this at least on some level. If you know the terms or not, but you need to be aware of which of your players are going to need, okay, it's 9 o'clock, time to get the fight in, otherwise Chris isn't going to be happy.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah, I have to say, there is something off-putting about the crunch of something like Hero System, but there is just something viscerally fun about having a handful of dice that you roll on the table.
Right, right, right. And that's what attracts people to FOSSA products in the first place. I don't think Shadowrun any edition has ever been fun, but everybody loves grabbing a fistful of dice. The players who love the game will complain about the game more than I ever could because they know everything that's wrong with it. But for me, it's just, what does this have to do with Dragon's Awakening and the Earth being descending into chaos and this cultural war going on between the rich and the poor? What does 14d6 have to do with that?
You know, I just want a game with one stat where I have to roll like 24 dice at a time. I'd be happy.
Not 24 different stats and charts.
Yeah,
24 dice.
You're going to have
your opportunity. Well,
I would agree with you that 14d6 probably doesn't necessarily have much to do with the Battle versus the Rich and the Poor and Dragon's Awakening, I would call it more of a just of a serene balance between the two.
I don't know why you call it that, but
you can get your fistful of D6 and you can get that visceral enjoyment. But yet at the same time, I actually the overarching storyline and a lot of the hidden things that were going on with the Shadowrun storyline, not necessarily just within gameplay, but I'm just talking about the overarching storyline that FASA did put forth, I actually enjoyed. And I thought they did a very good job of executing that for people who enjoyed that. Because, yeah, the rules, yeah, I could take it or leave it, but I really enjoyed the story that was running along there. Did I necessarily interact much with that with the games that I ran? No, but no. It was there and I enjoyed it as a gamer.
And I would love to see a company do that really well, right? Implement a system for how can I implement the mega story into my home story seamlessly, or at least with some sort of point structure as a GM or as a player, so that the things going on in your mega story as a publisher are actually affecting what's at my game table.
So if you look at some of these games, though, you have so much backstory that it's actually off-putting. Like when you go into Champions has years and years and years of history. D&D has all of this history. Battletech, what we're playing right now, there is so much history there that as a player, it's pretty easy to kind of jump in. But if you were going to run the game, knowing that your players know something about that world, right, that's always been off-putting to me, is just the amount of history to the story. Even if I'm enjoying the story, I don't want to have to read through 20 years worth of history of some of these worlds.
I don't think you have to understand. And here's why I'm going to say that. I have volumes of information on Skies of Glass in my head, and Mikey Mason took the challenge last year at Fear the Con and ran my own homebrew for me, for which he had almost no information, and ran one of the best games. I don't mean best Skies of Glass games. One of the best games I have ever played in.
Skies of Glass is a wonderful setting for that, too. It's a lot that you can understand. It's pretty easy to understand and grasp onto versus something like a fantasy setting.
I guess
a fantasy setting where you have to know these are what the races do and what they're like is a lot different.
I guess that's true.
Could he have done the same thing with Epoch of Rhysos? Probably he could have, but it would have been more difficult.
Yeah, okay. You know what? Now that I think about it, I concede that point, because you're right that there is Skies of Glass is a lot closer to reality, and also with the micro settings and whatnot allows for a lot of jump in that I don't think someone could do if they came to a group where everybody there was a Forgotten Realms expert and this was their first time ever touching the book. So I will concede that point.
Yeah, when the history has something to do with the mechanics that's being used as well, that makes it more difficult too.
Jim, I got a couple of minutes left, so I want to close this out on something that actually you raised and said you wanted to talk about here, which is marketing-driven game design.
Okay. When I was at Alderac, I just remember there was always felt like there's this odd tension between marketing and design, as if marketing didn't even know what we were doing until it was done, and then they were coming back and saying, okay, well, we need your game to be about this now.
Oh my gosh, I know exactly what you're talking about, but go ahead, finish your story, because I live this, because you and I had an interaction about this with something I wrote for Alderac, but go ahead.
Yeah, and so I think the perfect example, and there's a project that I did for them that I can't talk about, so the example I guess I'm going to have to use would probably be either the Swashbuckling Adventures book or 7th Sea even would be a good example of that. 7th Sea was supposed to be a pirate game, and the book that people ended up getting was this Renaissance courtier nobles in seven different nations kind of game that people actually eventually loved. But it wasn't what they were going to be promised to get. And at some point, marketing needed to stick its head in and say, look, you know, we're marketing a pirate game. We've planned this is going to be a pirate game. We need to make sure that there's pirates in here. And the inverse was true with something like Spycraft, which was this game that was just had so much crunch. And when it was all done and it was ready to go, the people marketing it wanted something fluffy like the James Bond role-playing game, which wasn't exactly fluffy, but fluffy in comparison. And so marketing didn't know what to do with this product either, because it wasn't what they were expecting to be selling to the consumer.
I remember because I was writing – this was back when you guys produced the real cheap D20 adventures, which were like four or five total pages. Yep. Essentially, it was 8.5 by 11 page that was folded lengthwise, and you threw a cover on it, and it was like $2.95. I mean, great product line and everything. It was between the ones that you guys were doing and Fantasy Flight were doing. It was great little mini adventures. And I was writing one for Alderac, and I had my plot and everything laid out, but I didn't have a title. You had emailed me a title and said you have to call it this, and I re-emailed you back and I said, it has nothing to do with any of the words in the title that you gave me. And you're like, yes, I know. And also put a dragon in there.
Hitman on the phone.
Yeah.
So what's the punchline? I mean, I understand the issue. What do you suggest as a solution? Should marketing be at the table during design? Should the designers pay more attention to marketing? Should marketing shut up and get out of the way? What's the moral to the story here?
Wow, this is going to sound so jaded and cynical, but I've had the unique opportunity of wearing every hat that you can wear in the gaming industry, short of being my own publisher, and I'm working on that. And what I've noticed time after time after time in every game company I've ever dealt with is that person in job X doesn't know what person in job Y does. They don't know the value of what they do, and they don't know what the importance of that role is to the final gestalt of the product. I think before people can even come to the table and sit down and say, okay, marketing really needs this and design really needs this, I think people need to know what the jobs are. You can't just come in and say, I'm the writer and my job's the most important, because that's not always the case.
So it's just poor collaboration?
It is. And a lot of it is everybody thinks they know better than everybody else. Gaming industry pays poorly on even poor standards. And so you have a lot of turnover in companies, or you have upstarts who are coming in the door and say, I don't care how little it pays, I just want my name in a book. And everybody comes in thinking they know better than everybody else. And I was guilty of this my first year at Alderac. I came in the door thinking I knew better. And some of the things that I knew were better, and some of the things that I knew were wrong, absolutely dead wrong. But I came in with a different perspective, and I thought, well, I should probably have these opinions now before that perspective gets ground down into the corporate mentality of what AEG wants. And that was probably actually, in hindsight, the wrong way to go, because once I'd been there a while, I saw kids coming in like that, and it was annoying. And nobody wants to work with that guy. Nobody wants to deal with that person. And it really, the collaborative effort has to happen with everybody coming to the table and saying, this is what I need. I will say this about the last project I did at Alderac, to put a little ribbon on this story, is that I designed 4 board games before I left the company. And they're all interrelated, and there was a story that I was writing about it, and there's all these different characters in there, and I had written a story, because there's 100 characters in there, I'd written a story that involved a lot of people, this ensemble cast story. And after I was done, after 15 months of work was done, somebody from marketing came to me and said, what we really want is a cool Star Wars kind of story.
Because that's never been done before.
And I thought, okay, well, what about Star Wars do you like? Do you like the fact that it's about this big giant world and the rebels are fighting against this oppressive regime? Do you like that there's this big villain that wears all black? Do you like that there's this kid that came from nothing and becomes the greatest Jedi ever? What is it about Star Wars that you like?
We like that people buy it.
Yeah, we like that people buy it. I could not get an answer, and it was too late anyway because the product was done. That was a conversation to have 15 months ago, when everything is done. And not knowing how much work goes into my role as both as the designer and the graphic designer and the art director and the writer of this project, I was wearing 4 hats on this game. I had so much work to do, and I had to coordinate all those internally without any kind of stopgap or any kind of quality assurance. Nobody was coming in to check on to see how well I was doing. To ask me at the end of it to change one of those roles, what I was doing in that role, meant that the other pieces were going to fall apart. Now you want a Star Wars story in this setting that's about monkeys flipping burgers. It's not about monkeys flipping burgers, but you get my point.
Right.
two monkeys kissing while they're flipping burgers.
Yes, in the 16th century.
Johan would totally play that.
Jim, I want to thank you very much for joining us again for a second time. I think we're going to wrap this episode up here. As for anyone listening to the show, usual thing, check the show notes for links to various things. Jim, is there a link you have for a blog or something?
My new project's called Post World Games.
Okay. So it's just postworldgames.com?
Yeah.
I will put a link to that in the show notes for anyone that's interested. So, Jim, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks,
all of you out there for tuning in. You guys have a great week and great games, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.